All week I've been reading Psalm 90 in the English Standard Version, our pew Bibles. I stumble each time I come to God's wrath, his fury against sin, and I call out for Jesus. Jesus, come, help. I'm eager to hear Zach's message this morning because he seems to have been gifted to see and point to Jesus in passages where I long for Jesus, but I can't see him. So this morning I'm reading this prayer of Moses from the New Living Translation. Lord, through all the generations, you have been our home. Before the mountains were born, before you gave birth to the earth and the world, from beginning to end, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, "Return to dust, you mortals." For you, 1,000 years are as a passing day, as brief as a few night hours. You sweep people away like dreams that disappear. They are like grass that springs up in the morning. In the morning it blooms and flourishes, but by evening it is dry and withered. We wither beneath your anger. We are overwhelmed by your fury. You spread out our sins before you, our secret sins, and you see them all. We live our lives beneath your wrath, ending our years with a groan. 70 years are given to us. Some even live to 80. But even the best years are filled with pain and trouble. Soon they disappear and we fly away. Who can comprehend the power of your anger? Your wrath is as awesome as the fear you deserve. Teach us to realize the brevity of life so that we may grow in wisdom. Oh Lord, come back to us. How long will you delay? Take pity on your servants. Satisfy us each morning with your unfailing love so we may sing for joy to the end of our lives. Give us gladness in proportion to our former misery. Replace the evil years with good. Let us, your servants, see you work again. Let our children see your glory. And may the Lord our God show us his approval and make our efforts successful. Yes, make our efforts successful.
Morning, everybody. Before I preach this text, we're going to make use of it according to its original intended purpose. The Psalms are God's extended answer to the age-old question, teach us how to pray. And this psalm is a great teacher in that it ends with a whole series of requests in prayer. You are not to be bashful about asking God for things. But it doesn't begin there. The first two-thirds of the psalm don't ask for anything at all. They're a meditation on reality. So prayer is asking for things, but it's more than asking for things. Prayer is also reminding ourselves of the truth. And this prayer does both. So let's pray. God, you are infinite and you are forever. You had no beginning and you will have no end. And yet you draw near to us and offer us shelter. You, in all of your infinity and all of your eternity, have made yourself a home for us. We who are as nothing before you, like the dust on the scales, like a dream that is so quickly forgotten. We who are fleeting because we are fallen. We who die because we have chosen death. You, God, are good enough to hate evil, and evil lives in us, and so we tremble before your wrath. And we admit that we are nothing without you. That we have, again, turned our backs on you. Be merciful to us, God. According to your steadfast love, be merciful to us. Look on us and take pity. Return to us not to pour out your wrath, but in order to give us grace. Not in order to confirm our exile, but in order to bring us back home. And may we find in you a home, a shelter from every storm, a place of joy in the midst of every sorrow. God, you are God. You are enough for us. And as short and as awful as these years can be, if you are with us, then we have enough. So let us be satisfied in you. And may we become yours. May we be your workmanship. May our lives be written as your poetry. May we find life in you, lasting life, meaningful life, life that transcends these short moments that we have right now while we're breathing, life that radiates beyond our selfishness. Life that is filled with your steadfast love. Life that ends in eternity with you. Give us these things, not because it is our nature to deserve them, but because it is your nature to give them. Amen. In North Carolina, just down the road from my grandparents' house, lives a folk singer by the name of Mike Cross. And Mr. Cross wrote a song called Uncle Josh, which is a big hit in our family because we have an Uncle Josh. But the chorus of Uncle Josh ends, "Listen here, brother. Life's just another terminal disease." It always ends the same way. Or a musician that you have a better chance of having heard of, Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy said, "Castles made of sand melt into the sea, eventually." We don't like hearing things like that, but we can't refute them. They are true. Soon, you are going to die. What do you do with the reality of death? What do you do with the reality of how short your life is? Do you just try to push it to the periphery and ignore it? Fill your life with so much busyness that you rarely, if ever, notice that every day you get a day closer to the grave? Do you fight against it? Buy all the right insurance policies, eat all the right things, get the right security system for your home. There's a t-shirt, I don't know if you've seen it, but it shows a cliff and a person lying broken and crumpled at the bottom of the cliff, and it says, "Gravity. I fought the law, and the law won." Listen, death is gravity. You can go out of here and rage against the dying of the light. And while you are raging, the candle will be burning lower and lower and lower. And the law will win. What do you do with the fact that you are going to die? That's the question that the psalmist, the writer of this poem, is wrestling with. He has the courage to face death, to face how short life is. And his answer for how to deal with it, his answer for what to do with the reality of death is very simple. He commits to knowing that death is a reality, and then he commits to asking God for help. That's it. That's the whole answer. Knowing and asking. That's what we are meant to do with death. And so we're going to walk through the psalm almost verse by verse and find knowing and asking. Those are our two points. So knowing. This is all of verses 1 through 11. They are about knowing. It is the glory of being human that you get to know. You get to know all kinds of things. You get to discover, to find out, to contemplate, to understand. You can know how to fix a carburetor or comfort a child. How to run a company or a classroom. You can know how to bake a pie, or you can know the value of pi to 25 digits. You get to know. And all of the things that you can know are good and are worth knowing. It's worth understanding the movements of the heavens, and it's worth trying to understand. My limited understanding is you can't actually do this, but trying to understand the movements of electrons and other subatomic particles. It is good to know. And it is good to know the foundation of knowing. What's at the very root, what we have to know first. John Calvin, for whom this church is named, said that all wisdom is rooted in two kinds of knowledge. Knowledge of God and knowledge of self. And that's exactly what the psalmist is getting into right here. I find myself wondering if Calvin wrote that line after reading Psalm 90. He talks about knowing God and knowing yourself. So to know begins with knowing God. And that's verses 1 and 2. And we learn two things about God. First, that God is moral. And second, that God is immortal. God is moral and God is immortal. So God is moral. Verse 1, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Dwelling place, it means a home, a place where you stay, where you live, where you spend your life. It also, it has connotations of refuge, of protection. It's a safe place to be. And the psalmist starts off saying that God is our dwelling place. Do you notice the language there? He does not say, God, you have provided for us a dwelling place throughout all generations. Thank you for giving us the land of Canaan. We really like it. He says, no. God, you are our dwelling place. God found me on the street and did not offer to pay my security deposit and first month's rent. He did not take me down to City Hall and get me signed up for Section 8. He took me to his home and said, stay with me. Not for a few days until you get back on your feet and can make life work on your own again, but forever. God is our dwelling place. This is the moral character of God. In the early 1940s, France was occupied by Nazi Germany. And as was the case everywhere that the Nazis ruled, Jews were unwelcome. They were being gradually rounded off and shipped off to concentration camps and exterminated. And there was a little village in the mountains of eastern France called Le Chambon, where the entire village committed itself to being a dwelling place for Jews. Any and every Jew who could find their way to Le Chambon would find a home there. The villagers weren't committed to providing supplies so that the Jews could go elsewhere. They weren't committed to providing funds or false papers. They were committed to providing a home. And they did this for years in the face of increasing pressure. They, when asked about it, said, look, we feel compelled to tell you, we have Jews in our village. We're not telling you where, and you can't have them. This is the character of God towards you. He is a God of welcome, of refuge. He is home. When you picture Jesus stretched out on the cross, picture his arms spread in embrace, saying, come and be with me. I came to be with you. God is moral. God is moral, and he is immortal, both moral and immortal. This is verse 2. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. If you look around the world, mountains are about as everlasting as it gets, yes? People die, Buildings fall apart, trees wither, rivers dry up, mountains are just there. Civilizations pass by mountains like wisps of cloud. They measure their ages in millions of years, and they are nothing compared to God. Before God brought them forth, he was. Mountains get brought forth, not God. Mountains age and erode and wear down, not God. He was, he is to come. From everlasting to everlasting, his being is not contingent on anyone or anything. No one brings him forth and no one brings him down. God is immortal. He always was and he always will be. Know God. Know that God is moral and know that God is immortal. And if you will know these things, then you will begin to know yourself. If you start to understand who God is, I'm not claiming that you can understand him fully, you can't, but you can know him genuinely. I stole that line from Andy. Give him credit when you see him. If you would know God genuinely, you will begin to know yourself genuinely as well. And you'll start to see yourself and see the gulf between you and God. And that's immediately where the psalmist goes, right? Verse 2 is all about how immortal God is. And verses 3 to 6 are all about how mortal we are. You return man to the dust and say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream. All of this, it's not about you. It's about 1,000 years. They're the watch in the night. They're the dream. They are like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. Do you have any concept of the eternity of God? Or are you like me, so busy living in the moment, so busy carpeing the diem, that you have no clue about time? There's a British comedian, Eddie Izzard. He did a tour in the United States, and he was poking fun at Americans specifically for having no concept of time. And so he tells a joke about the historical society of the city of Miami. And the historical society purchasing an old building in Miami and fixing it back up to turn it into a museum. And at the ribbon-cutting ceremony, they proudly announced, "This building has been restored to exactly the way it was over 50 years ago." No! Surely not! No one was alive then! It's worse on the West Coast, right? 1,000 years in God's sight are but as yesterday when it is gone. Brothers and sisters, you are mortal. 50 years is a long time to us. It's nothing to God. Our lives are fleeting. Picture with me standing at the northwest corner of the high school, just over here, and then driving south down 11th Street. And think of the names of the streets that you pass. Right, you start at Buchanan, and then there's Pierce, Fillmore, Taylor, Polk, Tyler. Then you get to the big one-way streets, Harrison, and Van Buren. I've been practicing. Those are the names of 8 successive presidents of the United States of America. So here are my questions for you. What are their first names? What party did they belong to? What are their major accomplishments? 25 years of the most powerful men in this country. I am not prepared to answer those 3 questions. Is anybody else in the room prepared to? I can do question 1. I know their first names. Yeah. Skip's not here to bail us out. Our lives come and go. They vanish. How much less will you and I be remembered than James Buchanan and Franklin Pierce and all the rest. We are mortal. Just like that. It's gone. Why? Why is life so fleeting? Why does it pass by so quickly, like a dream running through our fingers, and we can't even remember most of what we ourselves have lived? Why is it that we are mortal? The answer the psalmist gives and that the Bible consistently gives is that we are mortal because we are immoral. Our mortality, our brevity, is because of our immorality, because of our wickedness. And this is where the psalmist turns in verses 7 to 11. And I'm just going to start with 7 and 8. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath, by God's wrath, we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins, in the light of your presence. There's a clue that this answer is coming even earlier in the psalm in verse 3. The very first thing it says about human beings is, you return man to the dust. To dust we are, and to dust we shall return. Which was God's response to Adam when Adam chose to disobey God. When he chose the way of wickedness. When he chose the way of death. We are dying because we have chosen to die. And you say, hold up. Never once in my life have I said, what I really want to do is die. I'll get right on that. But when we choose to turn away from God, the source of morality, we are also choosing to turn away from God, the source of immortality. You can't have one without the other. When we choose a different morality, a different set of values, a different way of determining good and evil from God's, we choose a different life from his as well. When we reject God's morality, we reject his eternity. We choose death over life. Those are our iniquities. God is the God of infinite welcome, of bringing in those who have nothing to offer him. When the villagers of Le Chambon took in Jews, they weren't just protecting them, they were putting their own lives at risk. And when Jesus spread out his arms to embrace you, he wasn't just bringing you in, he was committing to dying on your behalf. That is the degree to which he desires to welcome you in. And we know that, and we know the goodness of that, and we choose differently. We know that in Jesus, God revealed his particular love for children. His passion for them, his desire to welcome them when they were the most inconvenient. And yet we say that if the mother or whomever happens to have influence over the mother finds a child in the womb inconvenient, it is okay not to welcome them. We here in Corvallis pride ourselves on being a community of welcome, a community of refuge to foreigners. And the vast majority of American citizens who live in Corvallis will never have a person from another nation in their home. Not one of the thousands of international students or visiting scholars. Not one of the immigrants, mostly Hispanic, who moved here not for the university but to find work. We won't welcome them in. We might take them down to City Hall and sign them up for Section 8. But that's not the character of God. And look, just like you, in my head, immediately the wheels start turning and I come up with excuses and reasons for why it has to be so and it just can't be any other way. And I understand that. I do the same thing, but that is not the character of God. That is not what he did for you. We turn away from God's morality. And our secret sins are in the light of God's presence. And in his wrath, he gives us the death that we have chosen. He He says, okay. If you want to live that way, you can. You want to turn your back on me, I will not force you to do otherwise. But when you turn your back on my morality, you lose out on immortality as well. You only get as much time as it takes to realize how little time you have. And the more time that you get, the more the reality of how little that time is will press in on you. At the end of Shakespeare's play, Macbeth, the title character, faces this reality. His wife dies early and somewhat unexpectedly. And Macbeth gives this iconic speech about the nature of time. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps this petty pace from day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That's the life we choose. And the invitation at the end of this section in verse 11 is to contemplate that. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So my question for you is, are you willing to consider? Are you willing to know God and know yourself and see the difference? About 120 years ago, the Times of London asked a bunch of the leading intellectuals in England to write essays answering the question, what's wrong with the world? And people wrote all kinds of long, brilliant, insightful essays. The shortest one was by a guy named G.K. Chesterton. And this is the whole essay. Dear sirs, in response to your question, what's wrong with the world? I am sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton. He got it. He's not saying he's the only thing, but it starts with us. The brokenness of the world lives in us. Are you willing to know that? To know how good God is and how good he intended us to be and how far we are from that intention? And if you know that, what are you going to do with that knowledge? What is the point of knowing that? Is it just to feel miserable? I can see everybody's shoulders going from here to here to here. Is that the purpose of knowing? No, not at all. Knowing is intended to lead to asking. Knowing that you are in need and that you cannot help yourself is intended to lead you to ask for help. My grandmother is in her 80s and her computer has gone bananas, right? She did what you're never supposed to do and just clicked on the yes, I'll download that. Yes, I'll do it. So it's just a mess, right? And she can't do anything about it. She needs to ask for help. And she needs to ask the sort of people who can help, not me, but somebody who knows how to make the computer better. And she needs to ask them for the sort of help that will help, right? It doesn't do any good to ask them to come over and make her dinner so that she can focus on fixing the computer. She's got to ask the right people for the right things. And that's what the psalmist turns to. He starts asking for help. He starts asking God, the one who can help and who in Jesus has shown himself willing to help. He says, look, I can't do anything about this. You are moral and I am not. You are immortal and I am not. And I can't close the gap. Will you help, please? And he asks essentially for four things, speaking somewhat broadly. He asks God for wisdom. He asks God for mercy. He asks God for joy. And he asks God for eternity. This is what the psalmist is trying to get us to ask for. And we'll go through each of those. He asks God for wisdom, right? This is verse 12. So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Wisdom is not seeing the big picture and how everything fits together. Wisdom in the Bible is knowing the one right thing to do and doing it. When you go up to PDX, you're entering an incredibly complex place. Hundreds of airplanes, thousands of pilots and co-pilots and flight attendants and mechanics and baggage guys and the folks who help you check in, all working in concert. There's this whole academic division called operations research that's in charge of telling computers how to figure that out because human beings cannot do it. Wisdom is not being an operations expert. Wisdom is knowing what gate you are supposed to go to and when your boarding time is and getting on the airplane. That's wisdom. And the psalmist says, ask God for that. You don't naturally have that. It's not just in there somewhere, and if you look inside and follow your heart, you will all of a sudden be wise. You have to ask God for it. And he says the way that God will give it to you is he will teach you to number your days. He will teach you to know that you are going to die soon. You've heard the idea of if you knew you had a year to live, if you knew you had a month to live, if you knew you had a day to live, what would you do? And there's kind of two categories of answers. There's the extravagant, totally selfish ones. I would go to Disney World and pay extra so that I didn't have to stand in the lines. Right? And then there's the ones that matter. I would call my brother I haven't spoken to in 30 years and ask him to forgive me. I would go see my child. I would tell my parents that I love them. You see what happens there? Knowing that you don't have much time left makes you wise. It gets your priorities in order. It lets you know, hey, boarding time is in 5 minutes. I don't care how good the food is in Terminal C. Don't wander down there. Ask God for wisdom. He will teach you how small you are and how to use what little you have well. Ask God for wisdom. If you ask God for wisdom, one of the first things you will realize is that the second thing you need to ask for is mercy. If you ask God for wisdom and he shows you the difference between him and you, you will realize that you need mercy. And that's the next thing the psalmist asks for in verse 13. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Do you feel the tension here? That we started off with God has been our dwelling place. God and us, we're supposed to be tight. We're supposed to be together, dwelling as one. And yet, verse 11, who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? We recognize that God is rightly angry at our wickedness. And so to ask him to return, to come back, to be with us, is a risky thing to do. It's just betting on the fact that God will be merciful. I have an entirely hypothetical scenario for you. Consider if, hypothetically, I were an abusive husband and a serial adulterer. Okay? Some of you don't look shocked enough at that idea. And Vanessa rightly and justifiably gathered our children and left. Took off and went somewhere else. Hopefully to one of you who then would not tell me but would keep her safe. What am I left with? I have a life of misery of my own making, right? Vanessa offered me a way of life, and again and again and again, I chose a different way. And finally, in her wrath, she said, okay, you chose to turn your back on me, you get to keep your back to me. I have a house, a dwelling place, but it's not a home anymore. And no matter how much I fix it up, or no matter how many other women I cycle through, it never will be a home again. Unless Vanessa comes back. Unless she is possessed by great mercy towards me and forgives me and returns. And then where I am will be a home. Now, I won't presume to hypothetically speak for hypothetical Vanessa in this hypothetical scenario. But God has spoken for himself. And when you ask him to return, and you ask him for mercy, he will say yes. Exodus 34, God declares himself to be the Lord, merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. And in 1 John, God promises that if you will confess your sins, he will be faithful and just to forgive you and cleanse you of all your unrighteousness. And Isaiah 55, he tells you, listen, seek me where I may be found. Let you who are wicked forsake their ways, and let you who are unrighteous turn away from their thoughts. Come to the Lord that he may have compassion on you, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Ask God for mercy, and the answer is yes. Whatever darkness you're carrying, whatever righteousness sullies you, God will forgive you. He will cleanse you and make you new and be your dwelling place throughout all generations. Ask God for mercy. Ask God for mercy and then ask him for joy. Wisdom and then mercy and then ask for joy, because joy is an extension of God's mercy. God's mercy is not just a shower to wash off your unrighteousness. God's mercy is also a set of clean and good clothing to see you through all of life that is to come. And that's what the psalmist asks for. Next, he asks for joy in verses 14 and 15. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. It's possible that the psalmist is just talking about the future. One day make everything better, but it's unlikely because he uses language that's specifically tied to earlier in the psalm. So the second half of verse 14 says that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Verse 9 says, for all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The same days. So this is not crying out for the night to come to an end, but for Jesus to be the light in the midst of the darkness. This is not crying out for God to make the storm stop, but for Jesus to be the rock in the midst of the storm. Not for your life to be devoid of sorrow, but for you to have joy in the midst of that sorrow. Ask God for joy. How could that be possible? How could you have joy in the midst of sorrow? The psalmist gives us the answer in the start of verse 14. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love. You notice what he didn't say? He didn't say, satisfy us in the morning because of your steadfast love. That would mean, like, Dawn, you love me, so will you give me everything I actually want? No, he said, satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love. Give me your steadfast love, and that will be everything that I need and want, and I will be satisfied. So it's asking for God to give us love and for that love to lead to joy, because there will be in us a wisdom, a recognition that love is what we really need. We're no longer speaking hypothetically. In real history of my marriage, I have lost track of the number of times when it seemed like everything is falling apart and there's nothing left for Vanessa and I to do but just sit there next to each other with our arms around one another and say, like, it's going to be okay. We're together. Like, when the rent check bounces, when bad stuff happens to our kids, like 50 times when we were working at the children's home and we had no idea what to do with the boy, at least you're here. We'll figure this out. That is the steadfast love of God. That whatever else is going on, whatever else is not going on, that you are certain should be, God is there and he loves you. He is merciful towards you, and he is your dwelling place. And that is enough. And that is joy. Ask God for joy. Ask God for joy, and then ask him for eternity. Last thing, ask God for eternity. This is verse 17. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. You know, it's not a shameful thing to want a legacy. It's not a shameful thing to want your life to be lasting and meaningful. God wrote eternity on your heart. You are supposed to desire that. And to find it not through your own strength, but through grace. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us. Favor is hen in Hebrew. It means grace. It's the same word. It's a free gift. God just decides to favor you. He just decides to give this to you. It's not something you earn or make for yourself. It is what God wants to give you. It is the full outworking of mercy. It is the fullness of grace that your life, your everyday existence, would become meaningful and lasting. That the lawnmowers you fix, or the sermons you preach, or the healthcare advice you give, knowing full well that your patient is not listening to you and is going to leave from your office and go buy a donut, that somehow that will matter. Grace takes the sandcastles you have been and washes away the sand and exposes the lasting rock underneath. It establishes the work of your hands by making you the work of God's hands. It takes this terminal disease and turns you into a vessel of healing. It prepares you not just to survive the storm, but to get to the other side and see that the storm mattered. Ask God for eternity. Ask Him by His grace to establish you forever. Brothers and sisters, what then shall we say to these things? Know yourself. Know that you are mortal and that you are immoral, and that apart from God, your nasty, brutish, and short life will come to a sandcastle's end under the waves of His wrath. Know that. Don't ignore it. But also know God. Know His mercy. And know that in God it is not meant to end like that. That your mortality and your immorality are not meant to be the final word, that they should be and can be in God fleeting things. That while they may exist now, they should be and can stop existing. That they don't have to be the end, because you don't have to be the end. And you don't have to be the end because you weren't the beginning. God is the beginning, and God is the end. God is the Alpha, and God is the Omega. And in Him, you will find a different kind of life. You were meant to be with Him. Before we sinned, before we turned our backs on the path that God had laid out for us and lighted fools the way to dusty death, we were meant to dwell with Him, to be ministers of Him, to reflect His moral character, His welcome, and His love. We were meant to do this for one another and for all creation. You were made to dwell with God and to walk in the way of Jesus. Know that. Know God and know who God has made you to be. And know that in Jesus, this will be your end. Know that in Jesus, Macbeth will be proven entirely wrong. That yes, on your own, your brief candle may be sputtering out, but that in Jesus, the eternal light of God has come to live in you. That yes, on your own, your life may be full of sound and fury, but that in Jesus, God has taken that very sound and fury, which seemed to signify nothing, and reworked it into a symphony with every note in its place, with every movement better than the one before. Know that God in Jesus has taken your mortality and given you His immortality. has taken your immorality and given you his morality. Know that in Jesus, the life of God conquers your death and that the light of God vanquishes your darkness. Know the grace of God and ask for it. Ask God for that grace, for his life and light to return to you, and God will say yes. God will be your dwelling place throughout all generations. God will establish the work of your hands because you will have become the work of his hands from now until everlasting. Thanks be to God who gives us light and life through our Lord Jesus Christ. Brothers and sisters, be steadfast and immovable, always abounding in the work of Jesus, knowing that in Jesus, your work and your lives will not be in vain.